guides us to the entrance of the airport, and then Daniel takes over the controls to deliver us to a drop-off point. Two officers appear from a small building and open the doors of the car to let us out. Daniel exchanges pleasantries with one while the other watches me. She looks angry, as if she wants to reach out and punch me. It's as if she knew Sarah. "I'm innocent," I want to tell her. "I didn't even do it." She is still watching when Daniel slips a slim wire handcuff around my wrist, fixing himself to me.
"I'm sorry," he says. "It's just protocol. It's switched off. It can't shock you."
The only good thing about it all is that we get fast-tracked through security and seats in premium economy. We don't talk much. Daniel tries to make light-hearted small talk every so often, and I grumble at him, letting it taper off each time. I wake up in darkness. I can only hear snoring, and the shuffle of warm bodies under blankets, and the muted hum of the engines. In places, the odd spotlight shines down upon a seat. Daniel is peering into my face, and I sense that he has woken me up deliberately. I sit up straight, embarrassed and angered by the idea that I might have been resting my head against his shoulder, sleeping with the enemy.
"This is the only time we can safely talk," he whispers. "I'm supposed to record every conversation I have with you."
I stare back at him, letting my lip curl at what feels like a poor attempt at coercion. Anything I do say may be given in evidence, I'd imagine. I am sullen. I'm not going to be tricked again by his smoothness.
"Look, I'm not going to sit here and say whether I think you did or didn't do it," Daniel replies, "but you need to be prepared."
He pauses as an air steward walks past and looks around before continuing to talk. I wait until his attention has turned back to me before pointedly rolling my head away from him. I stare into the beige abyss of the closed porthole. I wait for his reprimand, but it doesn't come.
"You might have an alibi, Isabel, but alibis can fall down in court quite easily. Sarah was murdered with opioid drugs that we can prove came from you. Your DNA was found on the canister on her body."
"What DNA? I never even met her." The unnecessary lie thickens in my chest.
"Strands of your hair were retrieved from her throat."
"What?" I jerk my head back around. "How?" Daniel shrugs. He is silent for a few seconds to let the implications of his words sink in. "It sounds bad. I realize that. My hairs must have still been on Yarrick. They must have been transferred onto her somehow, into her, before she was killed."
"So you came and found me after that," I say. "But why the talking me into this ridiculous experiment? If you thought it was me all along, why did you make me put my own life on the line to try and prove him guilty?"
I try to temper my voice, but I notice the man in front shift and roll his head. Daniel cautions me with his eyes.
"None of that sounds ethical," I continue. "Scrap that, none of it sounds legal."
"It's complicated."
Compulsive lying does tend to complicate things.
"You need to get a good lawyer," Daniel says, before dropping his voice even lower and leaning in closer to me.
He smells sweet, like vanilla.
"Valhalla are dangerous, Isabel. I think they've wanted to do this for a long time, but they haven't had the excuse. This was perfect. It was handed to them on a plate. Think about it. A heaven architect, one that's against them rolling out single opt-in, no less, becomes romantically involved with one of her clients before his wife is murdered. That's a gift."
Maya wanted me to help them do this right from the start.
She came to me and asked me to work with them and the FBI to figure out how to scrutinize the heavens of people accused of serious crimes. I shot her down. I stopped for a few seconds, letting my thoughts straighten themselves out inside my head. They haven't just set me up, Daniel. Someone from Valhalla killed Sarah so that I'd leave and Oakley's market price would fall. They knew that I'd come to India and look at ghost memories for them, just like they wanted from the beginning. Have you thought about that?
Yes, I have thought about that,
he says calmly.
I know Valhalla can be ruthless at times, but it seems a bit far-fetched, don't you think?
Oh, yes, because powerful corporations are always squeaky clean and ethical, I snap. They've used me, and now they want me gone.
My mind is reeling. I think back to entering Yarrick's heaven, being stuck in the basement room with him, his glassy stare, my panic attack.
There was nothing to suggest he did anything to hurt Sarah, or that I did.
I console myself with the fact that their little experiment didn't prove anything. It didn't prove that you could look into people's heavens and successfully uncover the deepest secrets of their soul. It only showed them how you might do it. I realize I'm not as angry as I expect. Once I would have rattled with it, audibly and visibly. I would have made a scene. But I've been worn down around the edges by sorrow and love and everything in between. Besides, I didn't find anything on Yarrick, did I? After all that, I found nothing.
He glances at me briefly before turning away.
Uh-oh. I shouldn't be telling you this.
He sighs heavily.
Think about when you were in Yarrick's heaven, when you were running along the cliff and experiencing it all through his eyes. Sarah's face was invisible because he didn't want her there, but you knew it was her, didn't you?
I fight back the discomfort to think about it again, dragging it up from the bottom of all my memories from that strange in-between world. It has sunk below all the others, I realize, as if it's been trying to hide itself, or because it is weighed down with dread.
We saw the bitterness towards her, Isabel. It appeared in the simulation and in the readouts. We saw the anger.
I was living out Yarrick's heaven. Most of those thoughts, those feelings were his. They weren't mine.
I know.
Daniel is still refusing to look at me.
It looked confused, admittedly, but it didn't look good either, especially not when we'd already found yours and Yarrick's DNA on Sarah's body.
You really think it was me?
I narrow my eyes at him and place my hand on top of his, accusatory yet pleading, angry yet cajoling. He doesn't speak for a very long time, and I don't take my eyes off his face for a second of it.
I think it was one of you.
Chapter 28. It is dull grey outside when the Metropolitan Police car picks us up from the airport, but there's a tiny gap in the cloud through which I can see a patch of ochre-tinted light. It is early morning, but it looks more like late dusk, or a tropical storm in London. I am staring up at it, trying to decipher the clouds from the sky, when Daniel opens the door for me and simultaneously reads me the caution.
I'm arresting you on suspicion of the murder of Sarah Woods. You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defence if you do not mention when questioned. Something which you later rely on in court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence.
The words rattle around my head as we travel to the police station. The unfairness of them stings. And yet I have this strange sensation that it was always coming to me. All along, I have made so many bad decisions. It's the least I deserve.
Daniel guides me to the end of a corridor filled with stale air. It's cold down here and I'm shivering. My arms are wrapped around myself and I'm too tired to be angry. I look at each one of the closed cell doors, but tear my eyes away before I can see through the grate. I want to be able to pretend that it's just me down here, that I'm just staying in a terrible hotel for a night.
"I got you a good one," he says, opening the door to a cell and gesturing to the four bare walls.
A felt blanket covers a bed in the corner. I can't tell if he's joking.
"Step inside."
We walk in together, and he gestures for me to lift my shirt away from my trousers.
"No belt, no jewelry."
I shake my head before I remember. "Oh, wait." I sit on the bed and unclasp the anklet, running my thumb over the cobalt blue glass before handing it to him along with my shoulder bag. "Look after it," I tell him. In return, he hands me the rolled-up ball of fabric he's been holding.
"To keep you warm."
I hold it out in front of me. It's a baggy woolen jumper. It looks as if it was hand-knitted for someone.
"You took the jet-lag pills on the plane?"
he asks. I nod and sit down upon the hard bed, wondering what time it is, but not bothering to look.
"Get some sleep."
He walks out of the door and locks it behind him.
"We'll be interviewing you in a few hours," he says through the grate. "You'll need to call a lawyer when you wake up."
I hear the click of a switch, and the room falls into darkness. It stops me from inspecting my surroundings too closely for dirt. Now I might sleep. I unwrap the jumper in my lap and pull it over my head. It reeks of damp cupboards and kindness. Loosening the blanket from where it's been tucked in around the thin mattress, I pull it over myself, right over my head, as I lie down. No light reaches me now, and I feel my body heat start to gather in the air pockets around me. I close my eyes. Chapter 29. It takes me a while to realize that the metallic clanging is the sound of a fist upon the door. I hear it swing open and I twist around. I feel as though I've only just dropped off to sleep.
"You have the right to legal representation," the woman says. She's dressed in a long suede skirt and a purple sweater that rides up over her belly.
She looks at me.
"Would you like to call your lawyer?"
"I don't have a lawyer," I mutter. The woman sighs.
"Fine. Do you want to speak to our duty solicitor?" she asks, folding her arms.
I struggle out from under the restraints of the tangled blanket and pull my hands out from the voluminous sleeves of the borrowed jumper. I rub my hands over my face and tuck my hair behind my ears. I hear the woman sigh again.
"I guess so, yes," I say. "I'll send him down,"
she mutters over her shoulder as she leaves, slamming the door behind her. The room is square and scantily furnished, unsettling in its perfect symmetry. There are no windows, only a sky-blue carpet and cloud-white walls covered in dirty scuff marks. I sit next to the duty solicitor on an uncomfortable bench, drawn up to the small table. He's a very tall, very thin man. Even sitting next to me, his head towers above mine. In a flat voice, he tells me I should get a lawyer and then say nothing at all.
"You seem like a feisty young woman, Miss Argent. I suggest that you attempt to keep that in check, just for the next hour or so."
I pretend to acquiesce. I fold my hands in my lap and imagine that the room smells of jasmine and star anise,
not the stench of decaying carpet tiles splashed with evaporated milk.
A stranger enters the room.
He's big, in every sense of the word, and dark-haired. Hair covers his head like a helmet and creeps down his forearms. He looks like a human that's been recreated from a child's felt-tip drawing. His shirt strains around his armpits, and it's only when he sits down that I realize Daniel is behind him.
I almost smile,
but then remember that he's the worst kind of traitor.
Daniel undoes the button on his jacket and settles himself down on the chair, avoiding my gaze. I watch as the man fiddles with some outdated recording equipment fitted into a panel on the surface of the table. I think longingly of my state-of-the-art table in my old office. I spent a weekend playing with it when it first arrived, learning how to activate simulations and access documents.
Where were you on the evening of Friday the 16th of September?
The stranger asks, flatly. His voice is as heavy as his brow. I at least expected an introduction and open my mouth to say so, but I can feel the gaze of the solicitor bore into the side of my head. He must have seen people like me screw this up before. No comment, I say dutifully.
Really? You've got no idea where you were.
I think of Don, my alibi, and decide that it seems plain stupid not to answer simple questions with a straightforward response. I was at home, I say, in my apartment. I speak in an imitation of Don's natural confidence. I was with my boyfriend at the time. I know Don will be true to his word. I hope they can believe him and that he doesn't turn out to be in two places at the same time. He's cleverer than that, surely. I can almost hear the solicitor groan. No comment, he whispers in my ear.
Was he with you between 6 p.m. and 7 p.m., would you say?
The officer asks, unfurling his codex and angling it away from me. Yes, definitely. I watch Daniel. He's resting one foot over his knee and his hands on his calf. His head is so far drooped down that I can't even tell if his eyes are open. Is he, too, pleading for me to shut up? It crosses my mind that I have known Daniel for almost as long as I knew Yarrick. Is this what would have happened if Yarrick and I had known each other for longer? Would one of us have eventually betrayed the other in some way? Did that short, sweet, dizzying couple of months leave no room for the truth?
What were you doing that evening?
The questions are so thick in my own head that I barely have room to process anymore. I don't know, I can't remember, I mutter. It was quite a long time ago now. But not that long. 6 weeks? It seems both more and less time than that. On the one hand, it doesn't seem enough to contain the things that have happened since, but then so much can happen so quickly.
Nothing springs to mind.
I shake my head. This is why you say no comment, I think, because then when you really don't have a comment, you avoid sounding like a complete idiot. Or a liar.
You don't remember anything?
He asks, raising his eyebrows in forced disbelief.
You know that you were at home, but you don't recall a single thing that happened that night.
He leans forward on the table, eyes focused upon me. I try to swallow my rising emotions back, but the unnecessary aggression in his face provokes me. Oh! Yes, wait, I remember. We were teaching our neighbours how to samba, naked. Or was that the night we were swinging from the chandeliers? I have such an exciting life, officer, that it's hard to think. The interviewer
sucks in his cheeks, and glances across at Daniel. Sorry, I say. I mean, no comment.
Wait.
Daniel waves his hand over the recording panel. It's the first word I've heard him speak. His colleague frowns, and at the same time, he nods. Daniel walks around the table, rubbing his chin. He crouches in front of me.
I don't think you did it, Isabel,
he whispers into my ear. His voice shivers with anger.
Is that what you needed to hear? For God's sake, help me out here. Help yourself out.
He speaks so quietly that I can barely make out his words. Afterwards, I wonder if I heard them correctly at all. He walks around the table and sits back down. His colleague watches him the entire time, his head moving like the second hand on an expensive antique watch.
Would you like to take over?
The man asks, his voice tight and accompanied with a sharp jut of the head. I look at Daniel, and I see what looks like confusion flickering across his face. It's as if he doesn't want to do it.
I don't think,
he begins, scratching his cheek. But then he must feel my gaze upon him because he looks up at me and I silently tell him, yes, go on. I will behave. I will be good. I finally realize the allowances he's made for me. The exceptions, the generosities, despite the fact I was a suspect all along. And I've thrown them all back in his face.
Okay, Ms. Argent.
He clears his throat and pulls his chair closer to the table so that he can lean his forearms onto it. He glances down at the codex that's tilted towards him.
You are a heaven architect by profession, correct?
No comment.
It's our understanding that the husband of the victim, Yarrick Woods, was one of your clients.
No comment. Daniel doesn't need to look back at the codex to know the next question. He knows it. I know it. But he seems to struggle.
You were also in a sexual relationship with Mr. Woods, weren't you?
Now the words are out. They sound more like an accusation than I expected. The straightness of his face masks some hidden undercurrent. It's like anger pricking at the hairs on my arms. Or jealousy. No comment. My voice wavers. The other cop and the solicitor have faded away. It's only Daniel and me in the room now.
Describe what happened on the afternoon of Friday, September 16th, when Mr. Woods came to your apartment.
His voice has steadied. It's as if he's on autopilot. As he strengthens, I can feel myself breaking. I feel as though cracks are appearing in my skull around the metal plugs. No comment.
You had sex?
No comment. Daniel looks at the codex again, where I presume the notes are, and then glances at his colleague. The man shrugs and turns his hands outward slightly.
This is your interview now,
he seems to say.
Do you believe that Mr. Woods was still having a sexual relationship with his wife up until the time of her death? I try to swallow back the dryness in my throat. I stare into Daniel's eyes. They are wide open. Neither eyelid flickers. No, I say.
What makes you think that? Does the idea make you angry?
No comment. I try to say it as levelly as possible, but at best it's a tortured whisper. I am behaving. I am doing what I was told, not for me, but for Daniel. And now he's taunting me with these questions. I know that he wasn't having sex with Sarah, because he was angry with her. And he was jealous. A tiny voice inside me whispers. The emotions I felt reverberate through me in that scene on the clifftop did not belong to me. They did not belong to me. They were his. They were all his. Yarick's hateful anger and his bitter resentment focused on the shadowy figure that he couldn't quite identify. As I sit here, at my lowest ebb, in a cold London interrogation room, shivering beneath the bright lights, a new memory rises to the surface. It's one I haven't been able to admit I even noticed before. In Yarick's body, occupying Yarick's mind, I watched my little daughter running ahead, and I looked at my wife and I thought, now. I could do it now, and no one would know.
My client is entitled to a break,
the solicitor whines. I almost jump. I'd forgotten he was there. Daniel sighs heavily and sits back from the table.
One more minute,
the first cop grunts as he looks down at the recording equipment.
How far was Mr. and Mrs. Wood's house from your apartment? How long did it take you to walk there?
He is rubbing his thumb along his middle finger, and I can hear the friction of his skin echo in my ears. It makes me want to smack his hand onto the table. No comment, I say, although I'm asking myself again what I did know about Yarick. It strikes me that I heard so many of his memories and stories from his past, but perhaps I missed the fact the man sitting beside me was little more than a stranger.
Would you care to tell us why you think your DNA might have been found on the body of Mrs. Woods?
He continues, clearly relishing the detail.
Do you have any thoughts on why your hairs were extracted from the back of her esophagus?
No comment, I say firmly, my strength returning at the craziness of the questions.
I'd like you to take a look at this document, please, Ms. Argent.
He swivels the codex around to face me. It's words, only words. What is it? I murmur. Daniel presses his lips together, and I see the gentlest shake of his head.
Oh, I'm glad you're taking an interest at last, his colleague continues.
These are transcripts taken from Mr. Wood's audio diary, which he seems to have recorded regularly from the time of his diagnosis right up until his death.
Would you care to, say, read this sentence aloud?
He leans over, angling the display back slightly so he can also see it. I stare back at him, dumbly.
No? Okay, DCI Leiden will read it out to you.
He hands the codex over to Daniel.
How about the entry dated Thursday the 15th, there?
He jabs at it with his stubby little finger. Daniel hesitates in taking the device. I watch him swallow and clench his jaw.
Well, what do you know? He begins. It only turns out that I was wrong for once in my too short life. I know we've had our differences, but I'm starting to see that this fucking illness has clouded my brain.
I fight back the tears at the sound of Yarick's words in Daniel's voice. Yarick's light tone is missing, but I can hear it nonetheless. I place his exclamation marks where Daniel only allows serious full stops. I want to close my eyes and escape with these words, let them transform me. But they are not the words I want to hear, not the words I expect to hear.
Perhaps Sarah should be in my heaven. We're a family, and I owe her that, after everything. I just bloody hope that I haven't realized too late
and that there's still time for Harry to change things. Daniel flicks his eyes up at me. I'm not sure what he must see in my face, if he sees anything at all.
It's Isabel I've got to think about, really. Maybe I should be honest. Maybe I owe it to her to explain that our affair has been a mistake, although she won't take it well. What a fucking mess.
I imagine the cool calm of his laughter. I know it was there. A mistake. A mistake. The word stabs at my heart.
He did come and see me that next day, of course.
I had to see you,
he had whispered in my ear. He came to make love to me.
He came to ask for something for the pain. Something strong enough to end it once and for all.
He did not come to tell me that he'd been wrong, that he loved her and not me. Nothing of the sort.
Time, gentlemen,
the solicitor says, breaking through the spell that's seeping out from my brain like weighted ink into the blood of every throbbing vein, artery and tiny capillary.
He and the officer push back their chairs without hesitation, while Daniel and I stare at each other, dazed.
The solicitor helps maneuver me out of the interview room.
He sits me down on a bench in the corridor and disappears, muttering something about fetching me some water.
I think he can see as well as I can that I need something stronger. I need oblivion. I grip at the edges of the bench. My knuckles are white. I sip at the water that has appeared next to me. It tastes white, like the rest of the world. I feel the familiar panic rising from my legs. It's a tingle at first, like pins and needles, until I remember what it means, and it starts to stab at me then, because I've looked it in the face and acknowledged it.
If I freak out now, they'll lock me back in that cell. They'll tie me down and they'll never let me out.
I hear footsteps, and I see Daniel striding down the corridor towards me.
I feel myself harden. The walls that Yarrick broke down are back up, and the very thought of a man consoling me is enough to snap me out of it.
I breathe in and out, slowly, as heavily as I dare. I fake a smile.
Hello, Daniel.
And as soon as I've said it, I'm fully aware that I sound completely and utterly mad. He looks down into my face, his forehead wrinkled in concern.
He doesn't ask me if I'm okay.
He doesn't say anything at all. And I see something pale unfurling behind his eyes that is the last thing I want to see right now.
A thing I never want a part of again.
Come on, we're getting out of here.
There is an urgency in his voice, as if he hasn't yet seen his own flag of surrender. I sit, unmoving, looking past him to the blank wall behind. I think about saying lots of things. I think about asking him what the point would be of going anywhere. I think of asking him to help me tease apart the barbed thoughts tearing through my mind. I could accept the idea that Valhalla may have framed me. It's in keeping with my opinion of them and of Maya.
But what if they haven't?
The diary, I murmur.
Do you think it's the truth?
Daniel shakes his head with what looks like sadness.
Just before their deaths, I think Sarah had kicked him out for good. But I can't be sure. Their family say nothing had been mentioned to them.
If Yarrick deliberately wrote a diary that was the opposite of what he thought and felt, then how did I figure in his life at all? I try to block out my doubts. Is it possible that Yarrick did it? That he framed me so perfectly?
Could his diary be an elaborate lie designed to burden me with a motive? It's the only possible explanation, and it reverberates in every cell of my body. He used you. He set you up. He never loved you. The lengths he would have gone to in order to cover his tracks blindside me. He let me be part of his heaven so that I would be so utterly won over by him, in order that a jury would look at me and see a scorned, husband-stealing mistress, not an innocent bystander. Did Yarrick also come that afternoon to tear hairs from my head as we clung to each other? Did he come to collect the pills and set everything up perfectly? If it's true, if this is what he's done, then I am lost. The shock grounds my feet to the floor so that they feel like they'll never move again. The questions collide and rebound in no particular order. I want to cut everyone out of me or scream them out. I want them gone. I want my mind to be vacant. And I must be insane, because I'm still yearning to be in my heaven with a man who may well have been a liar and a psychopath. A man who has taken everything from me, and who could have murdered his wife. I think of collapsing into Daniel's arms and crying. But, apparently, there's a part of me that still has some fight left, because what I actually do is tell him, there's only one place I'll let you take me. Chapter 30.
You're still under arrest,
Daniel says as we climb into the police car.
Now, unless someone applies for an extension, we have 24 hours in which to either charge you or release you. I'd prefer it to be the latter.
I stare at him. Why?
Jess twisted my arm,
he says, before telling the vehicle to take us to the Francis Crick Institute, Midland Road. The warm glow of the dashboard lights on this dull, rainy London morning matches my relief to be out of the station. The car moves cautiously down the narrow streets. We pause at the junction, and through the rain that clings and then falls down the glass, one of the shop window displays catches my eye. A robot is arranging cut pieces of fabric onto a mannequin, the sections forming the shape of a suit jacket. It moves back and forth over one shoulder as I watch it, seemingly checking the measurement once, twice, three times. There's no room for error. Daniel was like a robot, reading Yarrick's diary, trying to say those words without attributing emotion to them. He was trying to save me, but nothing could have made it sound colder.
I'm sorry,
he says abruptly, from the seat in front of me. I almost wonder if I was thinking aloud.
Yarrick's diary probably came as a shock. I wanted to get straight to...
It's okay, I say, cutting him off. I look back at the robot, which is still moving backwards and forwards across the body of the mannequin as we pull out from the junction and turn left onto Regent Street. The streets in this part of London are filled with Leela. We used to come Christmas shopping together here. I remember being younger, starting out at Oakley, and Leela taking me under her wing. She brought me somewhere near here, tucked away, to buy the new codex that I would use for work. As the car turns right and passes by the black beams of Liberty, I remember how we would go in on each of our birthdays and choose something tiny as a present from the other one, just so that we could get the regal purple bag embossed with gold. I crane my neck to seek out the gilded ship on the edge of the roof. Leela was the one who had pointed it out to me. I'd never lifted my eyes high enough before to notice it.
It's the Mayflower, she'd told me.
Now, I imagine tiny golden people aboard it, sailing towards freedom.
The car pushes on through the light mid-morning traffic, and I notice familiar corners where I remember saying goodbye to her for the evening. The car stops in traffic right outside the Palladium, and the theatre's gleaming array of light bulbs reminds me of the shows we saw together there. I remember joking about how perfectly her lipstick matched the red carpet beneath our feet as we skipped up the steps for the first time. I can't recall what we saw, but it was terrible. So bad that we giggled all the way through it and got told off by the couple behind us.
I miss her. I will always miss her. I grasp on to the veracity of the love we had for each other. I wasn't wrong about that. We're not far here from Wimpole Street and Oakley Associates, and beyond that is the corner of the street where Yarrick first kissed me, pulled me towards him with what seemed like lust, but in hindsight might have been an entirely different type of need. My breath steams up the window so that I lose sight of what's beyond it. I could rub it away with my hand, but instead I rest my head against the glass and close my eyes. These streets are filled with a life that is no longer mine.
"How are you feeling?" Daniel asks. But there's no reply I can give.
He clears his throat and lets the question dissipate. "Didn't your mate want to come with us?" I ask.
"He did, yes, but I told him we wouldn't be long."
"If Jess has some evidence, something she wants to show you, why are you bringing me?" I ask. "Shouldn't you have left me behind?"
Daniel twists right around in his seat.
"Jess wants you to do another experiment, Isabel," he says, meeting my eyes. "Do this, and we could have everything we need to close this case."
My teeth click together and my stomach drops. He stares at my face for a few seconds and then turns back around, and I can only see part of the back of his head.
"Can't you see that I'm trying to help you? I'm tearing the pages out of the rule book for this, for you."
"You arrested me! You have put me through hell!" I explode. But even I know that there's not as much fire behind my voice as there should be.
As much as I am angry with others, I am furious with myself, for my own stupidity, and for ever agreeing to get involved. The blame is mine. It does not lie with him. If he had never asked me to do what I've done, then I would never have seen my own heaven. I would never have met Yarrick one last time. I whisper the last thought quietly in my own head, barely letting myself acknowledge that I've created it. And then I recognize a sensation rising through the resentment. It's a survival instinct, a force for good, the drive to prove myself innocent. It finally takes over, pushing everything else aside. It is all that matters now.
"I had to arrest you, Isabel. This is out of my hands now."
I watch the way the neat, manicured curves of his nails are scratching at the armrest. I don't make a sound. I look out of the window again, watching the trees at the edge of the park ruffling their reddening leaves.
"I have been breaking the rules since the day I met you," he says.
His voice is so quiet that it's barely audible over the traffic, and I wonder whether he meant for me to hear him speak at all. Jess is waiting for us outside the Institute, at the top of the slope outside the atrium. She stands still, arms folded, as we approach through the paved courtyard, weaving around the shrubs. She looks older than I remember. Perhaps she is tired. Because of me? I wonder.
I look up at the building's glass walls and curving roof. Around that corner is where Daniel first found me, and saw that the passion of love and subsequent grief had opened me right up. I am not that vulnerable anymore, I say to myself. I say it silently to Daniel, too, challenging him with my eyes. Jess is completely passive until we reach her, and then she throws her arms around me and crushes me against her. I feel so weak suddenly that I worry I will collapse. I hold her awkwardly with one hand.
Shall we?
She says. Jess leads us inside, and we walk up the sloping glass walkway. Last time I was here, it was warm and sunny outside, a typical mid-September London day, and the glass had breathed. Today it is cold, and the glass is closed, insulating us against the threatening winter. So much has changed. Are we going to the electric lab? I ask quietly.
Yes,
Daniel says. Then, to Jess,
tell her what you told me.
Jess strides ahead, leading us from the walkway and down a corridor that feels familiar, but probably looks like every other corridor in this building. She glances back at me, and I see excitement, a tumult of possibilities dancing in her eyes.
We never really found what we were looking for in Yarrick's Heaven, did we? You never found it.
A voice moves as quickly as her feet. She knows we don't have long. I shake my head.
Just the scene on the cliff, she says, nodding. Those vague emotions. That were his, I say, forcefully, to both her and Daniel.
I know. Jess looks directly at me.
I know they were his.
That lifts me. I let myself relax a little. I let myself hope.
Jess is the kind of woman you want on your side. Sweet, friendly, but when push comes to shove, hard as nails.
We enter a lift, and Jess touches the button at the bottom of the display, letting it scan across her eye before the doors close and the lift drops. The three of us are silent.
I feel the same sensation that I felt when I got off the bus and stood above Anjuna's ragged cliffs.
That I could fall, and that would be preferable to any other option. There would be a safety in it, a safety in sinking into the pit of this building and never leaving. The lift doors open, and Daniel and I follow Jess as she takes a sharp left and then walks through a wide pair of metal doors. They slide open as she approaches and make a noise that I didn't notice the first time, a welcoming beep, as if they are pleased to see her. Daniel hangs back and pauses slightly to read the inscription that I know is above them.
We are electric, I say, over my shoulder.
The three of us move into the heart of the room, gathering around the pedestal and its misty projections.
Leela, I suddenly realize.
She's here? I ask Jess. She's safe? I look around into the veiled walls of the circular room, seeking out the telltale seams of the doors that I know line it. In one of them is what remains of Leela. In one of them is what remains of Yarrick. So many of my former clients are in here somewhere, their last functioning cells, living out lives that were never really theirs. Existing in heavens which might, it seems, be clouded in part by the shadows of reality. Now, this place seems like a prison. Sealed. Inescapable. A memory chamber. I promised my clients perfection. And I didn't deliver. They could be locked inside worlds which taunt them with their strongest recollections, emotionally turbocharged memories living a double life inside their mirror neurons, memories not only of the best moments but also of the worst. The darknesses that we hide, I think. I can't remember which room, Jess says, but yes, Leela's neurons are safe and sound. I've been monitoring her heaven for ghost memories, but so far nothing. It looks stable. Stable? Is that the most my clients can hope for? And yet I feel the familiar drug-like tug of my heaven. I know it's not possible, but it's as if I can sense my proximity to it. I am so close to where I can access it. The serotonin receptors hammer like pneumatic drills. But if Yarrick killed Sarah, then it is all ruined. My heaven will be a falsehood, lying in rubble inside my skull, sharp and jagged, cutting at the edges of every emotion. It would all need rebuilding, I think automatically, before wondering whether the scrap heap is where it should stay.
We don't have much time, says Daniel softly, trying not to look overawed by the display that twists and swirls into rainbows under Jess's fingertips. A light dances over his face and it looks like hope. I can't find myself able to hate him or even dislike him.
I turn my gaze towards Jess. I already have a sense of what they are asking me to do, and I am almost prepared. There is a strength in my heart in this place with these people, both alive and dead.
I wasn't prepared before, Izzy,
she says in that beautiful Irish lilt that makes it impossible not to warm to her.
They didn't give me time. We hoped.
I know. You hoped it would work, I reply. And it almost did.
But since I flew back from India, I've been looking more closely.
You remember when you first came here, when I showed you the trace of the mirror neuron? I nod, but she's already turned her attention to what's in front of her.
I listen to the suspended water droplets hiss and hum.
The mist flashes with a green light, and a door behind Daniel clicks into life. Jess waves us towards it and holds open the door as we walk in. Wordlessly, she places a fingertip on the dark surface of the panel that wraps around the room and taps. She takes the tiny cartridge which appears and presses it into the shallow cavity in the wall above the panel. As the machine begins to hum, she takes two slim pairs of glasses from her lab coat and hands them to us, pointing at the wall. I slip them on and see the dark blankness transformed once more into the augmented reality panorama of flashing lights, pinpricks in a star cloth.
I try to follow one point of light as it shoots across my field of vision, bumping into others, spinning and dancing with them before moving on.
Despite these encounters, it's alone, really. Always alone.
Wow, murmurs Daniel beside me. These are memories.
It's a more basic representation of the brainwave data than what we saw in India, says Jess. This is just what we use on a day-to-day basis to check a heaven is functioning properly. A way of looking in from the outside without needing any type of formal access.
She moves in front of the lights, breaking my train of thought.
Remember, is here. She points towards the bottom of the display at around her own knee height and traces a wave of light that shakes and trembles, but is remarkably steady compared to the rest of the vision.
A ghost memory.
Jess nods and moves her hand further up, running her fingertip along a separate pair of intertwined lines.
Three.
I nod and try to swallow, but something feels lodged in my throat.
This is Yarrick's heaven, isn't it? I ask.
Yes. I'm taken by surprise by the burst of fury that grips me. Cuts through my own words. I imagine the convertible crash taking us both up in a fireball. I imagine chasms ripping through the rugby field. I imagine taking him by the throat in the basement room and throwing him against the door. I tear the glasses from my face and hurl them at the lights, at the memories I so lovingly crafted into shape. "We need you to look at it more closely, Izzy," Jess says. I stand there shaking and feel Daniel put his hand on my shoulder. It's awkward, as though he's about to push me into the back of a police car rather than offering me comfort. Jess calmly retrieves the pieces of the glasses and puts them back into her pocket. She is frowning, and I can see the telltale puckering where her forehead was cut open in the attack on the hospital. I look around the room, at the invisible outlines of the cartridges that I know are buried in the black, featureless panel. "One of you can do it. I want nothing to do with it." I can't conceal the fear that pulls at my voice. Jess hears it. She comes to face me and runs her fingertips over my head, letting them catch on the metal plugs that I have almost forgotten are there. I know that this ghost memory is my salvation. I know that there are a thousand logical reasons why I have to do it, and they can't. This is just one of them. "We don't have much time, Iz," she says apologetically. Jess leads us back upstairs to her lab. I've been in it once before. It's a complete contrast to the sleek dimness of the electric lab. We walk down the aisle that runs through the middle of it. Men and women are hunched over microscopes and other unidentifiable pieces of equipment, which seem to be scattered randomly across every surface. Nervousness fizzes at my lips and my fingertips, but the calming odour of disinfectant, that familiar lab smell, fills my nostrils. I breathe it in deeply. It always transports me back to my undergrad degree, and the contentment of knowing that I was going to spend a whole afternoon somewhere so clean. My obsessions were much worse back then, I remember. A few people are clustered around a projection which shows some highly magnified neurons. They are engaged in urgent discussion, an argument, maybe, and their voices rise clearly above the soft hum of machinery and the otherwise hushed chatter that fills the lab. "Luke," Jess calls to one of the men in the group, "is it all set up?" He raises his hand to acknowledge her.
"Yep, room 5.
I feel his eyes linger on me as we walk on. My story must be the most salacious gossip they've heard for a while. If Valhalla and the investigative forces of our countries get their way, they'll be dealing with a lot more than this. There will be someone here every few days, sneaking a glimpse into the brain of a possible fraudster, hacker, or murderer." I briefly reconsider whether that would be such a bad thing. Jess beckons us down an aisle towards the end of the huge lab, through the door into a small room, into which is squeezed a sofa, a desk with an office chair, and a window. Behind the desk is a white metal door with the number 5 embossed into the centre. Jess gestures for us to sit on the sofa and closes the door we entered through. She leans back against the desk, holding its edges with her hands. As with the lab outside, I feel comfortable in here. But it reminds me of my own office back at Oakley and how irretrievable it is to me. Daniel sits forward on the edge of the sofa and assumes his listening pose, fingers pressing into a bridge, his forearms rested on his knees. I notice the characteristic wave of one of my hairs ruining the lapel of his jacket and fight the urge to pick it off. I look away again, at Jess, thinking of those brown waves of mine threaded down the back of Sarah's throat, tickling and scratching at its dry, terrified surface. Jess rests her eyes upon me, and I remember that for the moment I have a new purpose. It's one that will kill me or save me. "So," she begins, allowing a few seconds for us to fully focus on what she's about to say.
I looked first at the mirror neurons that were activated in Valhalla's lab when you were in that cliff scene. That seemed to be the closest we could get to any potential lead because, although Yarrick didn't recognize Sarah, it looked as if he had an emotional response to her. She pauses.